dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We have been talking all week, and I suspect we'll be talking into the future for some time, about where we are in that war for the free world. And I'm very pleased to have with us a man who has been thoughtfully contributing to it for quite some time, and certainly commentating on it of late, by the name of Peter Wehner. He is currently a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., but he formerly served in senior positions in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He was also a deputy director of speechwriting for President George W. Bush. So it's particularly appropriate to be able to visit with him about a presidential address that was made earlier this week. Peter, welcome to have you with us at Secure Freedom Radio. Great to talk with you.
Thanks. It's a delight to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start, before we get to the professional assessment of the speech that the president gave earlier this week, and talk a little bit about where we are, as I say, in this war I think of as having at its stake for us the very free world of which we have been a leader for so long. I visited yesterday sort of briefly and serendipitously with a colleague of ours who sort of bemoaned the fact that one day we were a superpower and the next day we're not. The day I think she had in mind was the president's address. Is that really what's happened? Was it an overnight thing, or has this been building for quite some time?
No, I think it's been building for quite some time. And I think it's been building really throughout the Obama presidency. It's really the arc of his presidency. It seems to have metastasized in some ways with Syria, because I think there's been such an epic ineptness that we've seen on display. And now with Russia essentially displacing the United States as the key world actor in the Middle East, I think that that's had a kind of galvanizing moment. It's really unmasked and unveiled President Obama for what he is. But I do think that this has been in motion.
And how would you describe what he is now that he has been unmasked, Peter Wehner?
I would describe him as being a person who is extremely ambivalent on the use of force, very weak and irresolute. I think he is a product of a particular ideological and academic milieu, which looked toward American power with a lot of reservation and hesitation and some amount of criticism in terms of the post-war history of the United States. And I think we're looking at a person that doesn't understand the nature of the enemy we face in radical Islam. I think it's a very, very toxic combination that we have in this particular man.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. Now, Peter, again, let me take advantage of the fact that you were a presidential speechwriter for President George W. Bush, not to get a partisan assessment, but to get a professional assessment. The president made a 16-minute or so address from the White House to the nation to talk about Syria, to talk about the challenge that we face there, to talk about his strategy for dealing with it, to talk also about these parleys that are going on now in Geneva between the United States and Russia. How did he do? And to the extent that it really put into very sharp relief the trends that you've just been describing, where does it leave us at this point?
Well, I think it leaves us in a very, very bad situation. I think that we're essentially an impotent superpower right now, or at least perceived that way by much of the world for justifiable reasons. In terms of the craftsmanship side of the speech, how well did he do? I don't think he did well at all. It's not only that it was an unmemorable speech. So a week from now, I suspect that hardly anyone could quote a single line from the speech. But I think it was worse than that. It was at its core incoherent. I think there was almost a bipolarity to the speech. The beginning of it was a kind of lead up to war. He described in vivid detail what Bashar al-Assad has done, why he's a war criminal. And then he pulled away and argued in the second half of the speech why he's not going to do anything.
Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And having described Assad as a war criminal, he's essentially saying we're going to let him off the hook. Remember, the premise of the president's strike on Syria, the one that he wanted, was to punish Assad for using chemical weapons. But his position now is that there will be no punishment at all. It is now that we're going to remove chemical weapons from Syria, which is absurd and impossible to do. And the third thing I would say about the speech is you have a president who is trying to prepare America for a military action, and then spending part of his speech talking about how he was elected to end wars. And there was at some fundamental level, it captured the deep ambivalence and ambiguity of President Obama. He doesn't know his own mind. He doesn't know what to do. He is at sea, and he's thinking out loud. And that's a very, very damaging thing for a commander-in-chief to do, as you know from your experience with one of the great ones, Ronald Reagan.
Indeed. It does not inspire confidence, that's for sure. Peter Wehner is our guest. He is a former speechwriter for George W. Bush and had served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations before that, currently with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Peter, let me ask you about one line from the speech, because I think it speaks to something you've written about recently. In terms of your own disinclination to support this strike in Syria, the president asserted that if, quote, with modest effort and risk, we can stop children from being gassed to death, unquote, we have an obligation to become involved and you know, undertake that that effort. Did you find that, evidently before he said it, obviously, but in the wake of his remarks, an implausible characterization of what we're confronting at this moment?
Absolutely. I mean, this notion of modest effort, what Secretary of State Kerry referred to as an unbelievably small strike earlier this week, that's not the kind of thing that you want to do when you're going to war. If you go to war, you better go in to wage it and to win it. And the idea of...
But we're not going to war. We're supposed to be just sending signals and shots across the bow. And again, this goes back to what you were saying, Peter, about this bipolarity or ambivalence or simple incoherence. I'm not sure which it is, but maybe it's all of the above. How does anyone take away from this a sense that we have in this commander-in-chief somebody who should be followed into what may well prove to be war?
I don't think there is, and I think that that's why public opinion is so low when it comes to support for any military strike. I quite agree with you. I mean, in some deep sense, we wouldn't be going to war with Syria with Barack Obama as commander-in-chief, because he wouldn't prosecute it as you would hope to prosecute a war. The trouble is, once you bomb a country, you are at war with them. And that is really what gets to why I would have voted no if a use of force authorization had put before me for Congress, because I think it would get us in the worst of all possible worlds. It would get us militarily involved in a very, very complicated civil war with a man who's commander-in-chief who isn't willing to prosecute the war to a successful conclusion. I think that that would be a disaster.
I fear we may be in the process of doing that in this back doorway with arming the opposition, but we'll be talking about that with some of our guests later in the program. But let me just finish. As a man who's been in the messaging business, what did you make of Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, Peter Wehner?
Well, several things. One is I thought it was an insult to America, and I thought it was ludicrous that this brutal dictator is lecturing the United States on human rights. But I also took it to be what I think it was, which was a sign and a symbol that Putin has really risen in rank, that the United States is now on the sidelines, that Putin has now positioned himself to much of the world as a peacemaker, and that he was essentially spiking the ball in the end zone. He has utter disdain for President Obama. He goes out of his way to insult him. He takes great delight in it, and he finds that every time he does that, he gets no pushback from the president. So
maybe even rewarded for it.
That's right. The idea is, well, if we're nicer to him and if we're more compliant, that that he'll treat us less badly. I do think that op-ed was a bad sign in terms of the trajectory of both American power and Russian power, but it really was, I suppose, inevitable given the weakness of Barack Obama.
Right, and the practices that have brought us to this pass over the past 5 years. Peter Wainer, we have to let you go, but please come back again soon. Terrific talking with you. Thanks for the work you're doing at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and keep it up. Next up, the Discovery Institute's John Wallstetter talks with us about what possible outcomes could there be for the U.S. negotiations with Russia. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back joined by John Wallstetter. He is a very astute observer of the kinds of geostrategic developments we're talking about at the moment involving Syria and Russia and American power and preeminence in the world and so on. He's currently a senior fellow at the Seattle-based Discovery Institute, whence he writes a wonderful blog titled Letter from the Capital. He is the author of several very interesting and important books, including The Long War Ahead and The Short War Upon Us, as well as, most recently, Sleepwalking with the Bomb. John Wallstetter, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, great to be with you and your audience again.
We've been talking with Peter Wehner in the previous segment about what's going on at the moment in terms of the kind of recalibration of the United States as the world's one superpower. You are in the moment, I think, addressing a similar kind of perspective that perhaps from the other side of the coin, though. Talk a little bit about Russia and what its position is at the moment as ours seems to be diminishing.
Well, I believe that Russia has reset the Mideast. Essentially, 40 years ago, when Sadat in 1972 expelled the Russians from Egypt, and then in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War, we managed to avoid Russian troops getting back into the Mideast, although at the cost of a nuclear confrontation in the Mediterranean in the Yom Kippur War. Basically, we emerged as the preeminent outside power player in the region, and the Russians were marginalized, relegated to supporting their Stalinist client state, Syria, under the father, Hafez Assad, father of the current thug that runs Syria.
And, of course, also helping a variety of various smaller thugs. Yasser Arafat comes to mind and so on.
Exactly.
Indeed.
Exactly.
John Wallstetter, we've been visiting a little bit about the developments that have diminished the stature of the United States. I ascribe that to Obama policies in no small measure, and the ascendancy, particularly in the Middle East, of the Russians. Give us a sense as to how that changed dynamic is likely to play out in the negotiations John Kerry is now having with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov.
Well, let me quickly speak about the negotiations and then try and look at the larger picture, Frank.
Good.
The negotiations, you basically have three things that are possible and one that is not. One is that there's no deal at all, which restores the parties to the statu quo ante, except more people will have been killed and Syria will have had more time to hide certain assets. The second is a bad deal from our perspective, which the Russians and the Syrians, goaded by the Iranians, will gleefully insist be obeyed, and Western media will surely make sure we obey to the letter, no matter how bad it is for us. The third is a deal that is good for us on paper, which Russia and Syria, goaded by Iran, will cheerfully ignore without worrying about any comparable pressure from Western media. The one thing that is not in store is a deal that is good for us that will be honored by all sides. In a larger sense, Russia has reset the Middle East and given us what I think is the worst setback for American Mideast policy since Eisenhower's disastrous 1956 bubbling during the Suez Crisis, when he forced French, Israeli, and British forces to give the Suez Canal back to Egypt's then pan-Arabist tyrant Gamal Abdel Nasser. Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal, illegally seizing a waterway and interfered with traffic on it, and it would have been perfectly proper to overthrow him. The failure to do so led to the radical revolutions of July 1958. Eisenhower was praised for sending troops to Lebanon, but the real significance was that it installed Ba'athist tyrannies, Ba'ath for Rebirth Party, in Syria and in Iraq. These became, in the fullness of time, by 1970, Hafez Assad established a Stalinist state in Syria, and equally another secular Stalinist model, Saddam Hussein, in 1976. That also triggered the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, the Ayatollah Khomeini in the disastrous year of 1979, coming to power in Iran, partly due to the ineptitude of the Carter administration and the perfidy of France. And around the time of the November 1979 seizure of 52 hostages for the hostage crisis that ended the day that Ronald Reagan became president, there was a seizure, little noticed, of the mosque by Wahhabi militants, the Sunni side of militant Islam, with, of course, Khomeini being a 12er Shia. And so the result of that, the French helped liberate that, but the devil's pact that was made was between the Al Saud clan and the Wahhabi, and that is that the Al Saud would look the other way while the Wahhabists spread hatred of the West around the world in countless Saudi-financed mosques paid with petrodollars.
Right.
And the Wahhabis would look the other way while the Al Saud disported themselves in the pleasure palaces of Europe.
And there's been a lot of all of that going on. John Wohlstetter is our guest. He is the author, of, among other things, of The Long War and Sleeping with the Bomb. And I just want, John, this is a marvelous historical rendering of how we've gotten to this place. I do want to take just a moment before we run out of time with you, though, to visit about a very, very powerful indictment of President Obama that you wrote in your blog letter from the Capitol entitled Syria and Presidential Power. And you talk about the fact that President Obama is the commander-in-chief as being, quote, scary, unquote.
Well,
talk what might be coming if he is either supported or not supported in his gambit here with Syria.
Well, basically, he is AWOL. He's not a commander-in-chief at all. And I think that there's a very good chance that at the end of his term, we will be less of a factor on the world stage than we have been in a century since Woodrow Wilson in April 1917 took America into the First World War. I think that the voters at last November saddled us with a president whose presidency will have inflicted immense, perhaps catastrophic damage on America and its allies. Much, perhaps most of the damage will likely prove irreversible, with the reversible portion likely taking decades to undo.
Yeah. Now, John, do you agree with Norman Podhoretz, who wrote earlier this month, earlier this week, I guess now, it's been such a long week, that this is by design, not by accident, not sheer incompetence?
You know, this is one of these things where on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I think it's by design on Tuesday,
Thursday.
Thursday and Saturday, it's a spectacular ineptitude, and on Sunday, I think each is half a factor. It's just absolutely, we have put in there someone who is totally unfit to serve. Jimmy Carter was a bad president. He was very unpresidential at times, but even Jimmy Carter would not have been, for example, AWOL during the Benghazi thing, event as it was unfolding. And although Carter was hugely inept, whether he would have seized something as absurd as, you know, out of a misstatement that Kerry made, he shouldn't do shtick in public, he's not good enough at
no,
it.
Needless to say.
They would have fallen for this thing from Putin, although it's possible Carter would have. I think, though, that what we're seeing here is, among other things, it's going to be read in Israel, today being Yom Kippur and 40 years ago, although different date, October 6th, because of Yom Kippur moving was the start of the Yom Kippur War.
Right.
The Israelis are on alert today, and I think what the message they're going to take out of this week is that Obama does not have their back on Iran. They will not believe a single thing he says.
I fear that you're right, John Wohlstetter. We have to leave it at that. We'll be speaking more on these issues, I know, with you. John, thank you so much for your time. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, the possibilities of actually ridding Syria of chemical weapons, that subject and more with Dr. Mark Schneider straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If President Obama actually launches airstrikes to change the momentum of the battlefield in Syria, one woman may be more responsible than just about anybody else. Her name is Elizabeth Obagi, and her assessments of the nature and relative influence of the so-called moderates she claims could take over from Hafez Assad have been cited as authoritative by Secretary of State John Kerry, Senator John McCain, and press outlets like The Wall Street Journal and NPR. But Obagi is hardly an objective source. Largely undisclosed is her role as a paid consultant and political director for the Syrian Emergency Task Force, which seeks arms and help for Assad's opposition. That is a blatant conflict of interest and a scandal if allowed to influence whether America goes to war in Syria. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined by Dr. Mark Schneider. He is one of the most accomplished, knowledgeable, and dedicated former public servants now that I have ever encountered. I had the privilege of working with him for a number of years in the Pentagon, but he worked in several other agencies as well over a really remarkable career of government service. He is currently at the National Institute for Public Policy, where he is a senior analyst, but he is one of the country's great corporate memories when it comes to matters involving arms control, compliance, verification, denial and deception, and so on. So he's the obvious person to talk to about what might come of any possible deal that could be struck between the United States and Russia over disarming Syria of its chemical weapons. Mark Schneider, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. You've had a very kind introduction.
Well, heartfelt and justified. Let me talk a little bit with you about this idea that Syria is going to get into the Chemical Weapons Convention, something it has declined to do before now. It's going to acknowledge that it has chemical weapons, something it had declined to do until very recently. Mark, is there a snowball's chance in hell that we will find out where they have all their chemical weapons and that they will actually get rid of all of them, especially if, as the Wall Street Journal is reporting today, there's a Unit 450 that is frantically moving them all over the place into something like 50 sites at the moment?
Well, I think the answer to that is obviously no. There is, I think, almost zero possibility that we would succeed in negotiating an agreement along the Putin proposal, which the Obama administration has accepted. And even if we did, the most likely result would be no destruction or removal of their chemical arsenal and a lot of dead American inspectors in the process.
No removal at all, or just the removal of what they're willing to let us see, but not the full Monty by any means?
Well, I mean, I'm very pessimistic that you get any sort of agreement in the final analysis. But beyond that, if you take a look at what happened in Iraq in the 6 years between the end of the Gulf War and the end of inspections in 1998, when Saddam Hussein just threw out the inspectors, almost nothing accomplished to actually destroy or remove chemical and weapons that he had. All that happened was they were inventoried and tagged, and all, you know, inspectors routinely went back and read the tags. So, yeah. You know, but he kept the material. And I suspect the same thing would happen in Syria. The only different factor is there was no civil war going on in Iraq at the time, and now there's one in
Small
Syria.
Detail.
Yeah, small detail. And the insurgents don't want the chemical weapons removed because they want to inherit them.
Right.
And guess what they'll do with them if that happens?
Well, given that some of them are Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, it's very likely they will be used against us or people that we care about, notably, I guess, the Israelis. You know, Mark, one of the things, you are one of the country's real authorities on the lengths to which the Russians in the past, and presumably today, and certainly their fellow totalitarians have gone to engage in a practice known as denial and deception. We had Bruce Bechtol on, who's, as you know, a very knowledgeable expert on North Korean activities. And he says that the North Koreans have been all over Syria building, among other things, probably tunnels in which some of this stuff could be secreted. Talk a little bit about this problem as it just inexorably undermines the best intentions in the world, if anybody believes that these totalitarians have such intentions. Certainly those who are their negotiating partners have such intentions, when denial and deception is practiced to undermine any such agreements.
Well, denial and deception is almost universal among authoritarian and totalitarian states, and it's one of the biggest problems you have in both threat assessment and in arms control implementation. It is a very serious problem. We don't know nearly as much about your typical hard target authoritarian or totalitarian governments that we really need to know.
Indeed.
And it is a very, very serious problem.
Indeed. I want to come to how this bears on another very serious problem, namely Iran, about which you've been writing in just a moment. But before we leave this topic altogether, Mark Schneider, the National Institute for Public Policy, say a word or two, very briefly, if you would, about one, something that we hear about every so often but not very frequently, namely that Syria may also have biological weapons as well as chemical weapons. And secondly, Mark, while you're at it, whether Russia also has chemical weapons and biological weapons stashed away that they're not supposed to have under treaty obligations either.
Well, the answer, I think, to that is yes. In the case of Syria, you can actually read about this in the Obama administration's own compliance report, which the last one was in August 2013. In the case of Russia, you really have to go back to the 2005 report of the Bush administration or any of the Clinton administration compliance reports, and it'll tell you that the Russians are in violation of both chemical and biological weapons convention, and they have, you know, they have private programs.
Not the kind of people that you really want to have being the honest brokers in any disarmament program with the Syrians.
It's real irony.
Yeah, well, let me turn to another of the Russians' friends, the Mullahs of Tehran, and what they're up to. We're being told throughout this thrash about whether to strike Syria that this is necessary to enforce red lines to keep the Iranians from getting nuclear weapons. You've publicly mused in a recent posting under the headline, "Has Iran covertly acquired nuclear weapons?" That they have. Talk a little bit about that and where we would find ourselves if that proves to be the case.
Well, I think there's a substantial possibility that they have covertly acquired nuclear weapons. At this point, small in number and low in yield, but that's going to rapidly change in both characteristics and numbers.
How could it be otherwise, Mark Schneider? It boggles my mind. It took us 3 years to go from not having even a concept of a nuclear weapon, or at least an atomic weapon, to having dropped two of them. And that was without advanced computers, that was without all of the scientists, that was without all of the technology that's currently available. The Iranians have been beavering away at this for 20 years. How could they not have gotten their hands on this stuff already?
Well, that's my
your
point.
Your thesis.
that's one of the reasons to take the actual reports of this happening with some real credibility. I believe that the weapons they have at this moment in time are probably covertly purchased from the North Koreans, but I think they're at the point of when you take a look at the recent information they've announced, they've got 18,000 centrifuges, several times the number we previously heard about, yeah, or at least twice, and they're much more capable version. And when you take a look at the recent report of a covert plutonium facility in Iran, reactor and heavy water plant that hasn't been inspected for 2 years, I think they are literally on the verge of going into serial production of a more advanced type of nuclear weapon than the reports of their, you know, covert acquisition from North Korea would indicate. And that's a very serious problem in light of the de-emphasis of nuclear deterrence in this administration and the damage that's been done to our missile defense program.
Yes, indeed.
By cuts in both numbers of interceptors, although they've recently reversed that, and killing the advanced kill vehicle program, miniature kill vehicle, and inadequate sensor support.
Yeah. And the airborne laser, oh, yeah, and on and on. Mark Schneider, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but there's much more to talk about with you on this, not least of which I'd love to visit at some point near term about whether the North Koreans might have sold an EMP or electromagnetic pulse weapon design to the Iranians while they were at it. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy, thanks for your terrific insights. Keep up the good work there. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. He'll tell us what we do when the enemy of my enemy turns out to be my enemy.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, the man who takes us for a tour of what's going on inside the ring each week. That's the title of his wonderful column at the Washington Times. He is also a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, and he has been doing this week, as ever, splendid reporting, among other things, on some of the topics we've been discussing today. And Bill, let's start with your assessment of what the probabilities are that out of all of this Syrian chemical weapons business, we might find them migrating, as Mark Schneider sort of alluded to, into the hands of terrorists.
I think the possibility is real high for that. You know, when this first disarmament plan was came out, I thought back to the television show Smiley's People, where the head of British intelligence says to his friend, "Ever buy a fake picture, Toby? The more you pay for it, the more valuable you think it is." And I think that the U.S. is just beginning here to buy a fake picture. These chemical weapons, according to an Israeli think tank study, which I reported on, these chemical weapons are highly vulnerable. Right now, the Assad regime controls the major urban areas, and yet the chemical warfare stockpiles are located in the northern part of the country and the eastern part of the country, areas where the rebels are gaining ground, and in the case of the northern part, specifically the Al-Qaeda-linked rebels. So the report also noted that the rebels have made numerous advances on several weapons depots in the past and were unsuccessful. The Obama administration has said, in the person of General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that their latest assessment is that the regime still controls the stockpiles. But I'm not so certain about that.
Yeah, and you've been musing about the possibility that there's been breakdowns in the command and control. There certainly seems to be a frantic effort on the part of the government, Bashar Assad, to move them around. As we were discussing earlier, the Wall Street Journal says that the so-called Unit 450 responsible for them has been schlepping them around to something like 50 sites around Syria. And the chances that there will be a mishap or that they fall into even worse hands than Assad seem to me to be virtually certain. Bill, speaking of this rebel business, we're now, we're told, beginning to arm them. I guess still technically covert, but it's becoming more overt by the day. We're told that the Pentagon is going to start doing some of the training. Is there any greater clarity at the moment as to who is actually going to be getting these arms and training and whether they are in fact, as one WAG, Connor Higgins, put it, the enemy of my enemy turns out to still be my enemy, as in Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood?
In this case, I think that's accurate. In the situation in Syria, as far as the rebels go, is very dire in terms of the nature of these rebels. And I did a piece this week for the Free Beacon, which talked about that, and it looked at the differences in assessments. And of course, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, and Senator John McCain have tried to insist that the rebels are moderate, when in fact, the intelligence on that shows that 50% and more are tightly linked to the Islamists. I heard a report recently, and in fact, it was the retiring deputy CIA director who said that many of the so-called moderate rebels have aligned themselves with the Al-Qaeda rebels because they see in them a chance to achieve an effective success in
fighting
the Assad regime.
Yeah, the al-Nusra Front, I guess. It seems as though Kerry and McCain, among others, were principally relying upon this young woman, Elizabeth Obeghi, who has since been exposed, really, as somebody who has been promoting the Syrian opposition line, but happens to work for the Syrian opposition in doing so. Let me turn, Bill, to another aspect of this fight. You've written in Inside the Ring about Syrian hackers and what you're making of them now and trying to do to counter them.
The FBI has identified the Syrian Electronic Army as a pro-regime hacking group that has carried out effective attacks on social media, and notably the New York Times and Twitter. This advisory that was sent out in late August obviously came amid the heightened tensions over the Syrian chemical attack, and it's clear that this is a new form of warfare that's emerging. Now, on the U.S. side, I've also reported that the U.S. will conduct cyber attacks as part of its military operations, being the kind of the new emerging domain in the warfare spectrum, along with air and sea and space and land.
Yeah. You know, Bill, I have to say, and much as I admire your reporting and the sources that you are able to develop, it does alarm me a bit when we're telegraphing punches like that. And going back to the CW issue, the chemical weapons issue, the Wall Street Journal piece this morning talks about some fairly instructive sources and methods in terms of what we're doing to monitor and how we go about monitoring the movement of these chemical weapons, that it would seem to me it's very ill-advised to have in the public domain, especially if we're going to have to use military force against these guys.
Yeah, I agree. I think the U.S. should follow the Israeli example, where they conduct operations, and in the case of Syria, they've conducted a number of airstrikes there to take out missiles. And They don't send a save the date card, as the Dennis Miller joke the other night.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Bill, let me turn to a totally different subject, but one that I think speaks to a line that you have been helping to illuminate very importantly for some time. While we are focused on Syria, China is up to no good. Talk a little bit about what they're doing in the Senkaku specifically, and what our kind of one war posture portends if they're going to take advantage of our distractedness.
Yeah, this is a definite outgrowth of the massive focus of attention by the administration on Syria and the Middle East. And you have the Chinese ratcheting up the tensions with Japan over the disputed Senkaku Islands. These are a small group of uninhabited islands south of Okinawa and north of Taiwan. And just this week, the Chinese launched three military provocations. One was flying a strategic bomber called an H-6 through the Miyako Strait, which is that water between Okinawa and the Senkaku. So then they flew a surveillance drone in that same area, and then they sent six ships into waters of the Senkakus. And this coincides with the one-year anniversary of the Japanese government's purchase of three of these islands from private owners in an attempt to try and resolve the dispute with China. Instead, about a year ago, the Chinese triggered massive anti-Japanese riots throughout yes. China. So things yes. are heating up there.
And you mentioned in particular that at a moment when we are reducing dramatically our submarine warfare capabilities, the Chinese, among others, are building theirs up. Very quickly, talk about that, if you would, Bill.
Yes. Rear Admiral Richard Breckinridge, the head of submarine programs at the Pentagon, testified before the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Sea Power on Thursday and presented a fairly dire picture of the U.S. cutting its submarine force by about 30%, while China is building up its submarine forces along with those of Russia and Iran.
And these are not submarines that we have to cut up because they are obsolete. They're simply not ones we can afford anymore. Is that basically the issue?
Yes, and it includes forward deployed submarines, and it's a real problem. I mean, our submarine force is the key strategic asymmetric force. It's the force that we can use to counter anti-ship ballistic missiles by China, in particular, Iran's efforts to use asymmetric warfare against us in the Persian Gulf region, and the Russians, of course, are really engage in a robust strategic submarine buildup
they
with two types, long-range strategic missiles and conventional guided missile submarines.
Bill, we have to let you go. So much more to talk about. We look forward to doing so again with Bill Gertz, the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and the columnist at the Washington Times Inside the Ring column. Keep up the great work, my friend. We'll talk with you next week, and we'll talk with all the rest of you, I hope, again next week as well. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.